into a cocoonery, calling upon the fruit of Islam, as the military wing of the nation was known. She stood by while the young men pulled out the wooden commode from the rickety shack. They covered the cesspool with dirt and removed old pin-up calendars from the walls, averting their eyes as they threw the offending material in the trash. They installed shelves and perforated the ceiling for ventilation. Despite their efforts, a bad smell lingered.
"Just wait," Desdemona told them. "Compared to silkworms, this is nothing."
Upstairs, the Muslim girls training in general civilization class wove feeding trays. Desdemona tried to save the initial batch of silkworms. She kept them warm under electric light bulbs and sang Greek songs to them, but the silkworms weren't fooled. Hatching from their black eggs, they detected the dry indoor air and the false sun of the light bulbs and began to shrivel up.
"Got more on the way," Sister Wanda said, brushing off this setback. "Be here directly."
The days passed. Desdemona became accustomed to the pale palms of Negro hands. She got used to using the back door and to not speaking until spoken to. When she wasn't teaching the girls, she waited upstairs in the silk room. The silk room. A description is in order. So much happened in that 15-by-20-foot space. God spoke. My grandmother renounced her race. Creation was explained. And that's just for starters. It was a small, low-ceilinged room with a cutting table at one end. Bolts of silk leaned against the walls. The plushness extended floor to ceiling like the inside of a jewelry box. Fabric was getting harder to come by, but Sister Wanda had stockpiled quite a bit. Sometimes the silk seemed to be dancing, stirred by air currents of a mysterious origin. The fabrics flapped up and floated around the room. Desdemona would have to catch the cloth and roll it back up. And one day, in the middle of a ghostly pas de deux, a green silk leading as Desdemona backpedaled, she heard a voice.
"I was born in the holy city of Mecca on February 17th, 1877.
At first she thought someone had come into the room, but when she turned, no one was there.
My father was Alfonso, an ebony-hued man of the tribe of Shabazz. My mother's name was Baby G. She was a Caucasian, a devil."
"A what?" Desdemona couldn't quite hear or determine the location of the voice. It seemed to be coming from the floor now.
"My father met her in the hills of East Asia. He saw potential in her. He led her in the righteous ways until she became a holy Muslim."
It wasn't what the voice was saying that intrigued Desdemona. She didn't catch what it was saying. It was the sound of the voice, a deep bass that set her breastbone humming. She let go of the dancing silk. She lowered her kerchiefed head to listen. And when the voice started up again, she searched through bolts of silk for its source.
"Why did my father marry a Caucasian devil? Because he knew that his son was destined to spread the word to the lost portion of the tribe of Shabazz." 3, 4, 5 bolts, and there it was, a heating grate, and the voice was louder now. "Therefore, he felt that I, his son, should have a skin color that would allow me to deal with both white and black people justly and righteously. So I am here, a mulatto, like Musa before me, who brought the commandments to the Jews."
From the depths of the building, the prophet's voice rose. It began in the auditorium 3 floors below. It filtered down through the trapdoor in the stage out of which, at the old tobacconist conventions, the Rondega girl used to pop clad in nothing but a cigar ribbon. The voice reverberated in the crawl space that led to the wings, whereupon it entered a heating vent and circulated around the building, growing distorted and echoey until it rushed hotly out the grate at which Desdemona now crouched.
"My education, as well as the royal blood that runs in my veins, might have led me to seek a position of power. But I heard my uncle weeping, brothers. I heard my uncle in America weeping."
She could make out a faint accent now. She waited for more, but there was only silence. Furnace smell blew into her face. She bent lower, listening. But the next voice she heard was Sister Wanda's on the landing.
"You, Death? We ready for you."
And she tore herself away. My grandmother was the only white person who ever heard W.D. Fard sermonize, and she understood less than half of what he said. It was a result of the heating vent's bad acoustics, her own imperfect English, and the fact that she kept lifting her head to hear if anyone was coming. Desdemona knew that it was forbidden for her to listen to Fard's lectures. The last thing she wanted was to jeopardize her new job. But there was no other place for her to go. Every day, at 1 o'clock, the grate began to rumble. At first, she heard the noise of people coming into the auditorium. This was followed by chanting. She rolled extra bolts of silk in front of the grate to muffle the sound. She moved her chair to the far corner of the silk room, but nothing helped.
"Perhaps you recall in our last lecture how I told you about the deportation of the moon."
"No, I don't," said Desdemona.
60 trillion years ago, a god scientist dug a hole through the earth, filled it with dynamite, and blew the earth in two. The smaller of these two pieces became the moon. Do you recall that?"
My grandmother clamped her hands over her ears. On her face was a look of refusal, but through her lips a question slipped out. "Somebody blew up the earth? Who?"
"Today, I want to tell you about another god scientist, an evil scientist, by the name of Jacob."
And now her fingers spread apart, letting the voice reach her ears.
"Jacob lived 8,400 years ago in the present 25,000-year cycle of history. He was possessed, this Jacob, of an unusually large cranium. A smart man, a brilliant man, one of the preeminent scholars of the Nation of Islam. This was a man who discovered the secrets of magnetism when he was only 6 years old. He was playing with two pieces of steel, and he held them together and discovered that scientific formula, magnetism."
Like a magnet itself, the voice worked on Desdemona. Now it was pulling her hands down to her sides. It was making her lean forward in her chair.
"But Jacob wasn't content with magnetism. With his large cranium, he had other great ideas. And so one day, Jacob thought to himself that if he could create a race of people completely different from the original people, genetically different, that race could come to dominate the black nation through trichnology."
When leaning wasn't enough, she moved closer. Walking across the room, moving silk bolts aside, she knelt down before the grate as Fard continued his explanation.
"Every black man is made of two germs, a black germ and a brown germ. And so Jacob convinced 59,999 Muslims to emigrate to the island of Palan. The island of Palan is in the Aegean. You will find it today on European maps under a false name. To this island, Jacob brought his 59,999 Muslims, and there he commenced his grafting."
She could hear other things now. Fard's footsteps as he paced the stage, the squeaking of chairs as his listeners bent forward, hanging on his every word.
"In his laboratories on Palan, Jacob kept all original black people from reproducing. If a black woman gave birth to a child, that child was killed. Jacob only let brown babies live. He only let brown-skinned people mate."
"Terrible," Desdemona said up on the third floor. "Terrible, this Jacob person."
"You have heard of the Darwinian theory of natural selection. This was unnatural selection. By his scientific grafting, Jacob produced the first yellow and red people. But he didn't stop there. He went on mating the light-skinned offspring of those people. Over many, many years, he genetically changed the black man, one generation at a time, making him paler and weaker, diluting his righteousness and morality, turning him into the paths of evil. And then, my brothers, one day, Jacob was done. One day, Jacob was finished with his work. And what had his wickedness created? As I told you before, like can only come from like. Jacob had created the white man, born of lies, born of homicide. a race of blue-eyed devils.
Outside, the Muslim girls training in general civilization class installed silkworm trays. They worked in silence, daydreaming of various things. Ruby James was thinking about how handsome John 2X had looked that morning and wondered if they would get married someday. Darlene Wood was beginning to get miffed because all the brothers had gotten rid of their slave names, but Minister Fard hadn't gotten around to the girls yet. So here she was, still Darlene Wood. Lily Hale was thinking almost entirely about the spit-curl hairdo she had hidden up under her headscarf, and how tonight she was going to stick her head out her bedroom window pretending to check the weather so that Lubbock T. Haas next door could see. Betty Smith was thinking, praise Allah, praise Allah, praise Allah. Millie Little wanted gum. While upstairs, her face hot from the air rushing out of the vent, Desdemona resisted this new twist in the storyline. Devils, all white people, she snorted. She got up from the floor, dusting herself off. Enough. I'm not going to listen to this crazy person anymore. I work, they pay me, that's it. But the next morning, she was back at the temple. At 1 o'clock, the voice began speaking, and again, my grandmother paid attention.
Now, let us make a physiological comparison between the white race and the original people. White bones, anatomically speaking, are more fragile. White blood is thinner. Whites possess roughly one-third the physical strength of blacks. Who can deny this? What does the evidence of your own eyes suggest?
Desdemona argued with the voice. She ridiculed Fard's pronouncements. But as the days passed, my grandmother found herself obediently spreading out silk before the heating vent to cushion her knees. She knelt forward, putting her ear to the grate, her forehead nearly touching the floor. He's just a charlatan, she said, taking everyone's money. Still, she didn't move. In a moment, the heating system rumbled with the latest revelations. What was happening to Desdemona? Was she, always so receptive to a deep priestly voice, coming under the influence of Fard's disembodied one? Or was she just, after 10 years in the city, finally becoming a Detroiter, meaning that she saw everything in terms of black and white? There's one last possibility. Could it be that my grandmother's sense of guilt, that sodden malarial dread that swamped her insides almost seasonally, could this incurable virus have opened her up to Fard's appeal? Plagued by a sense of sin, did she feel that Fard's accusations had weight? Did she take his racial denunciations personally? One night, she asked Lefty, do you think anything is wrong with the children?
No, they're fine.
How do you know?
Look at them.
What's the matter with us? How could we do what we did?
Nothing's the matter with us.
No, Lefty, we... She started to cry.
We are not good people.
The children are fine. We're happy. That's all in the past now. But Desdemona threw herself onto the bed.
Why did I listen to you? She sobbed. Why didn't I jump into the water like everybody else?
My grandfather tried to embrace her, but she shrugged him off.
Don't touch me.
Des, please.
I wish I had died in the fire. I swear to you, I wish I had died in Smyrna.
She began to watch her children closely. So far, aside from one scare at 5, Milton had nearly died from a mastoid infection. They had both been healthy. When they cut themselves, their blood congealed. Milton got good marks at school, Zoe above average. But Desdemona wasn't reassured by any of this. She kept waiting for something to happen, some disease, some abnormality, fearing that the punishment for her crime was going to be taken out in the most devastating way possible, not on her own soul, but in the bodies of her children. I can feel how the house changed in the months leading to 1933, a coldness passing through its root beer-colored bricks, invading its rooms and blowing out the vigil light burning in the hall, a cold wind that fluttered the pages of Desdemona's dream book, which she consulted for interpretations to increasingly nightmarish dreams. Dreams of the germs of infants bubbling, dividing, of hideous creatures
growing up from pale foam. Now, she avoided all lovemaking, even in the summer, even after 3 glasses of wine on somebody's name day. After a while, Lefty stopped persisting. My grandparents, once so inseparable, had drifted apart. When Desdemona went off to Temple Number 1 in the morning, Lefty was asleep, having kept the speakeasy open all night. He disappeared into the basement before she returned home. Following this cold wind, which kept blowing through the Indian summer of 1932, I sailed down the basement stairs to find my grandfather one morning counting money. Shut out of his wife's affections, Lefty Stefanidis concentrated on work. His business, however, had gone through some changes. Responding to the fall-off in customers at the speakeasy, my grandfather had diversified. It is a Tuesday, just past 8 o'clock. Desdemona is left for work, and in the front window, a hand is removing the icon of St. George from view. At the curb, an old Daimler pulls up. Lefty hurries outside and gets into the back seat. My grandfather's new business associates. In the front seat sits Mabel Reese, 26 years old, from Kentucky, face rouged, hair giving off a burnt smell from the morning's curling iron.
"Back in Paducah," she is telling the driver, "there's this deaf man who's got a camera. He just goes up and down the river taking pictures. He takes the darndest things."
"So do I," responds the driver. "But mine make money." Maurice Plantagenet, his Kodak box camera sitting in the back seat beside Lefty, smiles at Mabel and drives out Jefferson Avenue. Plantagenet has found these pre-WPA years inimical to his artistic inclinations. As they head toward Belle Isle, he delivers a disquisition on the history of photography, how Nicéphore Niépce invented it, how Daguerre got all the credit. He describes the first photograph ever taken of a human being, a Paris street scene done with an exposure so long that none of the fast-moving pedestrians showed up, except for a lone figure who had stopped to get his shoes shined.
"I want to get in the history books myself, but I don't think this is the right route exactly."
On Belle Isle, Plantagenet pilots the Daimler along Central Avenue. Instead of heading toward the Strand, however, he takes a small turnoff down a dirt road that dead-ends. He parks and they all get out. Plantagenet sets up his camera in favorable light while Lefty attends to the automobile. With his handkerchief, he polishes the spoked hubcaps and the headlamps. He kicks mud off the running board, cleans the windows and windshield. Plantagenet says, "The maestro is ready." Mabel Reese takes off her coat. Underneath, she's wearing only a corset and garter belt.
"Where do you want me?"
"Stretch out over the hood."
"Like this?"
"Yeah."
"Good.
Face against the hood. Now spread your legs just a bit."
"Like this?"
"Yeah. Now turn your head and look back at the camera. Okay, smile. Like I'm your boyfriend."
That was how it went every week. Plantagenet took the photographs. My grandfather provided the models. The girls weren't hard to find. They came into the speakeasy every night. They needed money like everybody else. Plantagenet sold the photos to a distributor downtown and gave Lefty a percentage of the take. The formula was straightforward. Women in lingerie lounging in cars. The scantily dressed girls curled up in the back seat or bared breasts in the front or fixed flat tires bending way over. Usually there was one girl, but sometimes there were two. Plantagenet teased out all the harmonies between a buttocks curve and a fender's, between corset and upholstery pleats, between garter belts and fan belts. It was my grandfather's idea. Remembering his father's old hidden treasure, Sermin, girl of the pleasure dome, he'd had a vision for updating an old ideal. The days of the harem were over. Bring on the era of the back seat. Automobiles were the new pleasure domes. They turned the common man into a sultan of the open road. Plantagenet's photographs suggested picnics in out-of-the-way places. The girls napped on running boards or dipped to get a tire iron out of the trunk. In the middle of the Depression, when people had no money for food, men found money for Plantagenet's auto-erotica. The photographs provided Lefty with a steady side income.
He began to save money, in fact, which later brought about his next opportunity. Every now and then at flea markets or in the occasional photography book, I come across one of Plantagenet's old pictures, usually erroneously ascribed to the 20s because of the Daimler. Sold during the Depression for a nickel, they now fetch upward of $600. Plantagenet's artistic work has all been forgotten, but his erotic studies of women and automobiles remain popular. He got into the history books on his day off when he thought he was compromising himself. Going through the bins, I look at his women, their engineered hosiery, their uneven smiles. I gaze into those faces my grandfather gazed into years ago, and I ask myself, why did Lefty stop searching for his sister's face and start searching for others, for blondes with thin lips, for gun molls with provocative rumps? Was his interest in these models merely pecuniary? Did the cold wind blowing through the house lead him to seek warmth in other places, or had guilt begun to infect him too, so that to distract himself from the thing he'd done, he ended up with these Mabels and Lucys and Doloreses? Unable to answer these questions, I return now to Temple Number 1, where new converts are consulting compasses. Tear-shaped, white with black numbers, the compasses have a drawing of the Kaaba stone at the center. Still hazy about the actual requirements of their new faith, these men pray at no prescribed times, but at least they've got these compasses bought from the same good sister who sells the clothes. The men revolve one step at a time until compass needles point to 34, the number coding for Detroit. They consult the rim's arrow to determine the direction of Mecca.
Let us move now to craniometry. What is craniometry? It is the scientific measurement of the brain, of what is called by the medical community gray matter. The brain of the average white man weighs 6 ounces. The brain of the average black man weighs 7 ounces and 1/2.
Fard lacks the fire of a Baptist preacher, the deep gut oratory, but to his audience of disaffected Christians and one orthodox believer, this turns out to be an advantage. They're tired of the holy rolling, the shouting and brow mopping, the raspy breathing. They're tired of slave religion, by which the white man convinces the black that servitude is holy.
But there is one thing at which the white race excelled the original people, by destiny and by their own genetic programming. The white race excelled at trichnology. Do I have to tell you this? This is what you already know. Through trichnology, the Europeans brought the original people from Mecca and other parts of East Asia. In 1555, a slave trader named John Hawkins brought the first members of the tribe of Shabazz to the shores of this country. 1555, the name of the ship, Jesus. This is in the history books. You can go to the Detroit Public Library and look this up. What happened to the first generation of original people in America? The white man murdered them through trichnology. He murdered them so that their children would grow up with no knowledge of their own people or where they came from. The descendants of those children, the descendants of those poor orphans, that is who you are, you here in this room, and all the so-called Negroes in the ghettos of America. I have come here to tell you who you are. You are the lost members of the tribe of Shabazz.
And riding through Black Bottom didn't help. Desdemona realized now why there was so much trash in the streets. The city didn't pick it up. White landlords let their apartment buildings fall into disrepair while they continue to raise the rents. One day Desdemona saw a white shop clerk refuse to take change from a Negro customer. "Just leave it on the counter," she said. Didn't want to touch the lady's hand. And in those guilt-ridden days, her mind crammed with Fard's theories, my grandmother started to see his point. There were blue-eyed devils all over town. The Greeks had an old saying, too, red beard and blue eyes portend the devil. My grandmother's eyes were brown, but that didn't make her feel any better. If anybody was a devil, it was her. There was nothing she could do to change the way things were, but she could make sure that it didn't happen again. She went to see Dr. Philobosian.
"That's a very extreme measure, Desdemona," the doctor told her.
"I want to make sure."
"But you're still a young woman."
"No, Dr. Phil, I'm not," my grandmother said in a weary voice. "I'm 8,400 years old." On November 21, 1932, the Detroit Times ran the following headline: "Altar Scene of Human Sacrifice." The story followed. 100 followers of a Negro cult leader who is held for human sacrifice on a crude altar in his home were being rounded up today by police for questioning. The self-styled king of the Order of Islam is Robert Harris, 44, of 1429 Dubois Avenue. The victim, whom he admits bludgeoning with a car axle and stabbing with a silver knife through the heart, was James J. Smith, 40, Negro roomer in the Harris home. This Harris, who came to be known as the Voodoo Slayer, had hung around Temple No. 1. Just possibly he had read Fard's Lost Found Muslim Lessons No. 1 and 2, including the passage, quote, "All Muslims will murder the devil because they know he is a snake, and also if he be allowed to live, he would sting someone else." Harris had then founded his own order. He had gone looking for a white devil, but finding one hard to come by in his neighborhood, had settled for a devil closer at hand. 3 days later, Fard was arrested. Under interrogation, he insisted that he had never commanded anyone to sacrifice a human being. He claimed that he was the supreme being on earth. At least, that was what he said during his first interrogation. The second time he was arrested, months later, he admitted, according to the police, that the Nation of Islam was nothing but a racket. He had invented the prophecies and the cosmologies to get all the money he could. Whatever the truth of the matter, the upshot was this. In exchange for having the charges dropped, Fard agreed to leave Detroit once and for all. And so we come to May 1933, and to Desdemona saying goodbye to the Muslim girls training in general civilization class, headscarves, frame faces streaked with tears. The girls file by, kissing Desdemona on both cheeks. My grandmother will miss the girls. She has grown very fond of them.
"My mother used to tell me in bad times silkworms no can spin," she says. "Make bad silk, make bad cocoons."
The girls accept this truth and examine the newly hatched worms for signs of despair. In the silk room, all the shelves are empty. Fard Muhammad has transferred power to a new leader. Brother Karim, the former Elijah Poole, is now Elijah Muhammad, Supreme Minister of the Nation of Islam. Elijah Muhammad has a different vision for the nation's economic future. From now on, it will be real estate, not clothing. And now Desdemona is descending the stairs on her way out. She reaches the first floor and turns to look back at the lobby. For the first time ever, the Fruit of Islam do not guard the lobby entrance. The drapes hang open. Desdemona knows she should keep going out the back door, but she has nothing to lose now, and so ventures toward the front. She approaches the double doors and pushes her way into the Sanctum Sanctorum. For the first 15 seconds, she stands still, as her idea of the room switches places with reality. She had imagined a soaring dome, a richly colored Isin carpet, but the room is just a simple auditorium. A small stage at one end, folding chairs stacked along the walls. She absorbs all this quietly, and then, once more, there is a voice.
"Hello, Desdemona."
On the empty stage, the prophet, the Mahdi, Fard Muhammad, stands behind the podium. He is barely more than a silhouette, slender and elegant, wearing a fedora that shadows his face.
"You're not supposed to be in here," he says, "but I guess today is all right."
Desdemona, her heart in her throat, manages to ask,
"How you know my name?"
Haven't you heard? I know everything.
Coming through the heating vent, Fard Muhammad's deep voice had made her solar plexus vibrate. Now, closer up, it penetrates her entire body. The rumble spreads down her arms until her fingers are tingling.
How's Lefty?
This question rocks Desdemona back on her heels. She is speechless. She's thinking many things at once. First of all, how can Fard know her husband's name? Did she tell Sister Wanda? And second, if it's true he knows everything, then the rest must be true, too, about the blue-eyed devils and the evil scientist and the mother plane from Japan that will come to destroy the world and take the Muslims away. Dread seizes her, while at the same time she's remembering something, asking where she has heard that voice before. Now Fard Muhammad steps from behind the podium. He crosses the stage and descends to the main floor. He approaches Desdemona while continuing to display his omniscience.
Still running the speakeasy. Those days are numbered. Lefty better find something else to do.
Fedora tilted to one side, suit neatly buttoned, face in shadow, the Mahdi approaches her. She wants to flee but cannot.
And how are the children? Fard asks. Milton must be what now? 8.
He is only 10 feet away. As Desdemona's heart madly thumps, Fard Muhammad removes his hat to reveal his face, and the prophet smiles.
Surely you've guessed by now. That's right.
Jimmy Zizmo.
Mana!
Hello, Desdemona.
You!
Who else?
She stares wide-eyed.
We thought you died, Jimmy. In the car. In the lake.
Jimmy did.
But you are Jimmy.
Having said this, Desdemona becomes aware of the repercussions and begins to scold.
Why you leave your wife and child? What's the matter with you?
My only responsibility is to my people.
What people? The Mavros?
The original people.
She cannot tell if he is serious or not.
Why you don't like white people? Why you call them devils?
Look at the evidence. This city, this country. Don't you agree?
Every place has devils.
That house on Hurlbut especially.
There is a pause, after which Desdemona cautiously asks,
How you mean?
Fard, or Zizmo, is smiling again.
Much that is hidden has been revealed to me.
What is hidden?
My so-called wife, Somalina, is a woman of, let us say, unnatural appetites. And you, and Lefty, do you think you fooled me?
Please, Jimmy.
Don't call me that. That isn't my name.
What you mean? You are my brother-in-law.
You don't know me, he shouts. You never knew me.
Then, composing himself,
you never knew who I was or where I came from.
With that, the Mahdi walks past my grandmother through the lobby and double doors and out of our lives. This last part Desdemona didn't see, but it's well documented. First, Fard Muhammad shook hands with the fruit of Islam. The young men fought back tears as he said farewell. He then moved through the crowd outside Temple No. 1 to his Chrysler coupe parked at the curb. He stepped up on the running board. Afterward, every single person would insist that the Mahdi had maintained personal eye contact the entire time. Women were openly weeping now, pleading for him not to go. Fard Muhammad removed his hat and held it to his chest. He looked down kindly and said,
Don't worry. I am with you.
He raised the hat in a gesture that took in the entire neighborhood, the ghetto with its shantytown porches, unpaved streets, and disconsolate laundry.
I will be back to you in the near future to lead you out of this hell.
Then Fard Muhammad got into the Chrysler, turned the ignition, and with a final reassuring smile, motored away. Fard Muhammad was never seen again in Detroit. He went into occultation like the 12th Iman of the Shiites. One report places him on an ocean liner bound for London in 1934. According to the Chicago newspapers in 1959, W.D. Fard was a Turkish-born Nazi agent and ended up working for Hitler in World War II. A conspiracy theory holds that the police or the FBI were involved in his death. It's anybody's guess. Fard Muhammad, my maternal grandfather, returned to the nowhere from which he'd come. As for Desdemona, her meeting with Fard may have contributed to the drastic decision she made around the same time. Not long after the prophet's disappearance, my grandmother underwent a fairly novel medical procedure. A surgeon made two incisions below her navel, stretching open the tissue and muscle to expose the circuitry of the fallopian tubes. He tied each in a bow, and there were no more children. Clarinet Serenade. We had our date. I picked Julie up at her studio in Kreuzberg. I wanted to see her work, but she wouldn't let me, and so we went to dinner at a place called Austria. Austria is like a hunting lodge. The walls are covered with mounted deer horns, maybe 50 or 60 sets. These horns look comically small, as though they came from animals you could kill with your bare hands. The restaurant is dark, warm, woody, and comfortable. Anybody who wouldn't like it is someone I wouldn't like. Julie liked it. Since you won't show me your work, I said as we sat down, can you at least tell me what it is? Photography. You probably don't want to tell me of what. Let's have a drink first. Julie Kikuchi is 36. She looks 26. She is short without being small. She is irreverent without being crude. She used to see a therapist, but stopped. Her right hand is partly arthritic from an elevator accident. This makes it painful to hold a camera for a long period. I need an assistant, she told me, or a new hand. Her fingernails are not particularly clean. In fact, they are the dirtiest fingernails I have ever seen on such a lovely, wonderful-smelling person. Breasts have the same effect on me as on anyone with my testosterone level. I translated the menu for Julie, and we ordered. Out came the platters of boiled beef, the bowls of gravy and red cabbage, the canoodles as big as softballs. We talked about Berlin and the differences between European countries. Julie told me a Barcelona story of getting locked in the Parc Güell with her boyfriend after visiting hours. Here it comes, I thought. The first ex-boyfriend had been summoned. Soon the rest would follow. They would file around the table, presenting their deficiencies, telling of their addictions, their cheating hearts. After that, I would be called on to present my own ragged gallery. And here is where my first dates generally go wrong. I lack sufficient data. I don't have it in quite the bulk a man of my years should have. Women sense this, and a strange, questioning look comes into their eyes, and already I'm retreating from them before dessert has been served. But that didn't happen with Julie. The boyfriend popped up in Barcelona and then was gone. None followed. This was surely not because there weren't any. This was because Julie isn't husband hunting. So she didn't have to interview me for the job. I like Julie Kikuchi. I like her a lot. And so I have my usual questions. What does she want from? How would she react if? Should I tell her that? Nah, too soon. We haven't even kissed. And right now, I've got another romance to concentrate on. We open on a summer evening in 1944. Theodora Zizmo,
whom everyone now calls Tessie, is painting her toenails. She sits on a daybed at the O'Toole boarding house, her feet propped up on a pillow of cotton between each toe. The room is full of wilting flowers and her mother's various messes, lidless cosmetics, discarded hose, theosophy books, and a box of chocolates, also lidless, full of empty paper wrappings and a few tooth-scarred rejected creams. Over where Tessie is, it's neater. Pens and pencils stand upright in cups. Between brass bookends, each a miniature bust of Shakespeare, are the novels she collects at yard sales. Tessie Zismo's 20-year-old feet, size 4.5, pale, blue-veined, the red toenails fanning out like suns on a peacock's tail. She examines them sternly, going down the line, just as a gnat, attracted by the lotion perfuming her legs, lands on her big toenail and gets stuck. "Oh, shoot," Tessie says. "Darn bugs." She sets to work again, picking the gnat off, reapplying polish. On this evening, in the middle of World War II, a serenade is about to begin. It's minutes away. If you listen closely, you can hear a window scraping open, a fresh reed being inserted into a woodwind's mouthpiece. The music which started everything, and on which you could say my entire existence depended, is on its way. But before the tune launches into full volume, let me fill you in on what has happened these last 11 years. Prohibition has ended, for one thing. In 1933, by ratification of all the states, the 21st Amendment repealed the 18th. At the American Legion Convention in Detroit, Julius Stroh removed the bung from a gilded keg of Stroh's Bohemian beer. President Roosevelt was photographed sipping a cocktail at the White House. And on Hurlbut Street, my grandfather, Lefty Stefanides, took down the zebra skin, dismantled his underground speakeasy, and emerged once again into the upper atmosphere. With the money he saved from the autoerotica, he put down a payment on a building on Pingree Street, just off West Grand Boulevard. The above-ground zebra room was a bar and grill set in the middle of a busy commercial strip. The neighboring businesses were still there when I was a kid. I can dimly remember them. A.A. Laurie's optometrist shop with its neon sign in the shape of a pair of eyeglasses. New Yorker Clothes, in whose front window I saw my first naked mannequins dancing a murderous tango. Then there was Value Meats, Hagemoser's Fresh Fish, and the Fine Cut Barber Shop. On the corner was our place, a narrow single-story building with a wooden zebra's head projecting over the sidewalk. At night, blinking red neon outlined the muzzle, neck, and ears. The clientele were mainly auto workers. They came in after their shifts. They came in quite often before their shifts. Lefty opened the bar at 8 in the morning, and by 8:30, the bar stools were filled with men dulling themselves before reporting to work. As he filled their shelves with beer, Lefty learned what was going on in the city outside. In 1935, his patrons had celebrated the forming of the United Auto Workers. 2 years later, they cursed the armed guards from Ford, who had beat up their leader, Walter Reuther, in the Battle of the Overpass. My grandfather took no sides in these discussions. His job was to listen, nod, refill, smile. He said nothing in 1943 when talk at the bar turned ugly. On a Sunday in August, fistfights had broken out between blacks and whites on Belle Isle. "Some nigger raped a white woman," one customer said. "Now all those niggers are going to pay. You wait and see." By Monday morning, a race riot was underway. But when a group of men came in boasting of having beaten a negro to death, my grandfather refused to serve them. "Why don't you go back to your own country?" one of them shouted. "This is my country," Lefty said, and to prove it, he did a very American thing. He reached under the counter and produced a pistol. These conflicts lie in the past now, as Tessie paints her toenails, overshadowed by a much bigger conflict. All over Detroit in 1944, automobile factories have been retooled. At Willow Run, B-52s roll off the assembly line instead of Ford sedans. Over at Chrysler, they're making tanks. The industrialists have finally found a cure for the stalled economy. War.
The Motor City, which hasn't been dubbed Motown yet, becomes, for a time, the arsenal of democracy. And in the boarding house on Cadillac Boulevard, Tessie Zismo paints her toenails and hears the sound of a clarinet. Artie Shaw's big hit, Begin the Begin, floats on the humid air. It freezes squirrels on telephone lines who cock their heads alertly to listen. It rustles the leaves of apple trees and sets a rooster on a weather vane spinning. With its fast beat and swirling melody, Begin the Begin rises over the Victory Gardens and the lawn furniture, the bramble-choked fences and porch swings. It hops the fence into the backyard of the O'Toole boarding house, stepping around the mostly male tenants' recreational activities, a lawn bowling swath, some forgotten croquet mallets. And then the song climbs the ragged ivy, along the brick facing, past windows where bachelors snooze, scratch their beards, or in the case of Mr. Danilakov, formulate chess problems. Up and up it soars. Artie Shaw's best and most beloved recording from back in 39, which you can still hear playing from radios all over the city, music so fresh and lively, it seems to ensure the purity of the American cause and the Allies' eventual triumph. But now, here it is, finally, coming through Theodora's window as she fans her toes to dry them. And hearing it, my mother turns toward the window and smiles. The source of the music was none other than a brill-creamed Orpheus who lived directly behind her. Milton Stefanides, a 20-year-old college student, stood at his own bedroom window dexterously fingering his clarinet. He was wearing a Boy Scout uniform, chin lifted, elbows out, right knee keeping time within khaki trousers. He unleashed his love song on the summer day, playing with an ardor that had burned out completely by the time I found that fuzz-clogged woodwind in our attic 25 years later. Milton had been third clarinet in the Southeastern High School Orchestra. For school concerts, he had to play Schubert, Beethoven, and Mozart. But now that he had graduated, he was free to play whatever he liked, which was swing. He styled himself after Artie Shaw. He copied Shaw's exuberant, off-balance stance, as if being blown backward by the force of his own playing. Now at the window, he flourished his stick with Shaw's precise calligraphic dips and circles. He looked along the length of the shining black instrument, siding on the house two backyards away, and especially on the pale, timid, excited face at the third-floor window. Tree branches and telephone lines obscured his view, but he could make out the long, dark hair that shone like his clarinet itself. She didn't wave. She made no sign, other than smile, that she heard him at all. In neighboring yards, people continued what they were doing, oblivious to the serenade. They watered lawns or filled bird feeders. Young kids chased butterflies. When Milton got to the end of the song, he lowered his instrument and leaned out the window grinning. Then he started again from the beginning. Downstairs, entertaining company, Desdemona heard her son's clarinet and, as if orchestrating a harmony, let out a long sigh. For the last 45 minutes, Gus and Georgia Vasilakis and their daughter Gaia had been sitting in the living room. It was Sunday afternoon. On the coffee table, a dish of rose jelly reflected light from the sparkling glasses of wine the adults were drinking. Gaia nursed a glass of lukewarm Werner's ginger ale. An open tin of butter cookies sat on the table.
"What do you think about that, Gaia?" her father teased her. "Milton's got flat feet. Does that sour the deal for you?"
"Daddy!" said Gaia, embarrassed.
"Better to have flat feet than to be knocked off your feet forever," said Lefty.
"That's right," agreed Georgia Vasilakis. "You're lucky they wouldn't take Milton. I don't think it's any kind of dishonor at all. I don't know what I'd do if I had to send a son off to war." Every so often during this conversation, Desdemona had patted Gaia Vasilakis on the knee and said, "Milty, he is coming soon." She had been saying it since her guests arrived. She had been saying it every Sunday for the past month and a half, and not only to Gaia Vasilakis. She had said it to Jeannie Diamond, whose parents had brought her last Sunday, and she had said it to Vicky Logothetis, who had come the week before that. Desdemona had just turned 43, and in the manner of women of her generation, she was practically an old woman. Gray had infiltrated her hair, she'd begun to wear rimless gold eyeglasses that magnified her eyes, making her look even more perpetually dismayed than she already was. Her tendency to worry, which the swing music upstairs had aggravated of late, had brought back her heart palpitations. They were a daily occurrence with her now. Within the surround of this worrying, however, Desdemona remained a bundle of activity, always cooking, cleaning, doting on her children and the children of others, always shrieking at the top of her lungs, full of noise and life. Despite my grandmother's corrective lenses, the world remained out of focus. Desdemona didn't understand what the fighting was all about. At Smyrna, the Japanese had been the only country to send ships to rescue refugees. My grandmother maintained a lifelong sense of gratitude. When people brought up the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, she said, "Don't tell me about an island in the middle of the ocean. This country isn't big enough. They have to have all the islands, too." The Statue of Liberty's gender changed nothing. It was the same here as everywhere, men and their wars. Fortunately, Milton had been turned down by the army. Instead of going off to war, he was going to night school and helping out at the bar during the day. The only uniform he wore was that of the Boy Scouts, where he was a troop leader. Every so often, he took his scouts camping up north. After 5 more minutes, when Milton still had not materialized, Desdemona excused herself and climbed the stairs. She stopped outside Milton's bedroom, frowning at the music coming from inside. Then, without knocking, she entered. In front of the window, clarinet erect, Milton played on Oblivious. His hips swayed in an indecent fashion, and his lips glistened as brightly as his hair. Desdemona marched across the room and slammed the window shut. "Come, Milty," she commanded. "Gaia is downstairs. I'm practicing. Practice later." She was squinting out the window at the O'Toole boarding house across the yard. At the third floor window, she thought she saw a head duck down, but she couldn't be sure. "Why you always play by the window? I get hot." Desdemona was alarmed. "How you mean, hot? From playing?" She snorted. "Come. Gaia brought you cookies." For some time now, my grandmother had suspected the growing intimacy between Milton and Tessie. She noted the attention Milton paid to Tessie whenever Tessie came over for dinner with Sor Malina. Growing up, Zoe had always been Tessie's best friend and playmate, but now it was Milton whom Tessie sat in the porch swing with. Desdemona had asked Zoe, "Why you now go out with Tessie no more?" And Zoe, in a slightly bitter tone, had replied, "She's busy." This was what brought on the return of my grandmother's heart palpitations. After everything she had done to atone for her crime, after she had turned her marriage into an arctic wasteland and allowed a surgeon to tie her fallopian tubes, consanguinity wasn't finished with her. And so, horrified, my grandmother had resumed an activity at which she had tried her hand once before with decidedly mixed results. Desdemona was matchmaking again. From Sunday to Sunday, as in the house in Vithinios, a parade of marriageable girls came through the front door of Hurlbut. The only difference was that in this case, they weren't the same two girls multiplied over and over. In Detroit, Desdemona had a large pool to choose from. There were girls with squeaky voices or soft altos, plump girls and thin ones, babyish girls who wore heart lockets, and girls who were old before their time and worked as secretaries in insurance firms. There was Sophie Georgopoulos, who walked funny ever since stepping on hot coals during a camping trip. And there was Matilda Livanos, supremely bored in the way of beautiful girls, who'd shown no interest in Milton and hadn't even washed her hair. Week after week, aided or coerced by their parents, they came, and week after week, Milton Stefanides excused himself to go up to his bedroom and play his clarinet out the window. Now, with Desdemona riding herd behind, he came down to see Gaia Vasilakis. She was sitting between her parents on the overstuffed seafoam green sofa, a large girl herself, wearing a white crinoline dress with a ruffled hem and puff sleeves. Her short white socks had ruffles, too. They reminded Milton of the lace cover over the bathroom trash can.
"Boy, those are a lot of badges," Gus Vasilakis said.
"Milton needed one more badge and he could have been an Eagle Scout," Lefty said.
"Which one is that?"
"Swimming," said Milton. "I can't swim for beans."
"I'm not a very good swimmer either," Gaia said, smiling.
"Have a cookie, Milty," Desdemona urged.
Milton looked down at the tin and took a cookie.
"Gaia made them," Desdemona said. "How you like it?"
Milton chewed meditatively. After a moment, he held up the Boy Scout salute.
"I cannot tell a lie," he said. "This cookie is lousy."
Is there anything as incredible as the love story of your own parents? Anything as hard to grasp as the fact that those two over-the-hill players permanently on the disabled list were once in the starting lineup? It's impossible to imagine my father, who in my experience was aroused mainly by the lowering of interest rates, suffering the acute adolescent passions of the flesh. Milton, lying on his bed, dreaming about my mother in the same way I would later dream about the obscure object. Milton writing love letters and even, after reading Marvell's to his coy mistress at night school, love poems? Milton mixing Elizabethan metaphysics with the rhyming styles of Edgar Bergen?
"You're just as amazing, Tessie Zizmo, as some new mechanical gizmo a GE exec might give a pal. You're a world's fair kind of gal."
Even looking back through a daughter's forgiving eye, I have to admit my father was never good-looking. At 18, he was alarmingly, consumptively skinny. Blemishes dotted his face. Beneath his doleful eyes, the skin was already darkening in patches. His chin was weak, his nose overdeveloped, his brill-creamed hair as massive and gleaming as a jello mold. Milton, however, was aware of none of these physical deficits. He possessed a flinty self-confidence that protected him like a shell from the world's assaults. Theodora's physical appeal was more obvious. She had inherited Sormelina's beauty on a smaller scale. She was only 5'1", thin-waisted and small-busted, with a long, swan-like neck supporting her pretty, heart-shaped face. If Sormelina had always been a European kind of American, a sort of Marlene Dietrich, then Tessie was the fully Americanized daughter Dietrich might have had. Her mainstream, even countrified looks extended to the slight gap between her teeth and her turned-up nose. Traits often skip a generation. I look much more typically Greek than my mother does. Somehow Tessie had become a partial product of the South. She said things like shucks and golly. Working every day at the florist's shop, Lena had left Tessie in the care of an assortment of older women, many of them Scotch-Irish ladies from Kentucky, and in this way a twang had gotten into Tessie's speech. Compared with Zoe's strong, mannish features, Tessie had so-called all-American looks, and this was certainly part of what attracted my father. Sormelina's salary at the florist's shop was not high. Mother and daughter were forced to economize. At second-hand shops, Sormelina gravitated to Vegas showgirl outfits. Tessie picked out sensible clothes. Back at O'Toole's, she mended wool skirts and hand-washed blouses. She depilled sweaters and polished used saddle shoes. But the faint thrift store smell never quite left her clothes. It would attach to me years later when I went on the road. The smell went along with her fatherlessness and with growing up poor. Jimmy Zizmo, all that remained of him was what he'd left on Tessie's body. Her frame was delicate like his. Her hair, though silken, was black like his. When she didn't wash it enough, it got oily, and sniffing her pillow, she would think, "Maybe this is what my dad smelled like." She got canker sores in wintertime, against which Zizmo had taken vitamin C. But Tessie was fair-skinned and burned easily in the sun. Ever since Milton could remember, Tessie had been in the house wearing the stiff, churchy outfits her mother found so amusing. "Look at the two of us," Lena would say, "like a Chinese menu, sweet and sour." Tessie didn't like it when Lena talked this way. She didn't think she was sour, only proper. She wished that her mother would act more proper herself. When Lena drank too much, Tessie was the one who took her home, undressed her, and put her to bed. Because Lena was an exhibitionist, Tessie had become a voyeur. Because Lena was loud, Tessie had turned out quiet. She played an instrument.